to the cloud server.
Yes, thank you.
Whoa. Okay, now I will
We did
mute
it.
myself.
We managed. Thank you very much, Young. And yes, welcome everyone. Sorry for about the technical stuff that we faced this the challenge that we faced this for this talk. And today we have Hugh Dixon from the Open University to talk about the Zooniverse integration with ESAP. I will just give the floor to Hugh. Yeah, please go ahead. Thank you.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you. Yep, I've been asked to talk today a little bit about my experiences integrating Zooniverse with the ESAP data discovery platform. And hopefully, what I'll say will be generic enough so that you will be able to integrate your data source with the platform if you want to. As usual, a brief overview of what's going to be in the talk. The first thing, I recognize that some of you might not even know what Zooniverse is, so I will very briefly go over what I mean by Zooniverse. I'll do a little demonstration of the functionality that has actually been implemented so far so that you can see the types of things I'm going to be showing you how to implement yourselves. I'll give a hopefully quite a brief overview of how the ESAP data discovery platform is actually set up architecturally in terms of both the data model and the front-end back-end communication. Then we'll go into a little bit more detail talking about how the back-end actually works, the things that you'll need to do and implement within the back-end in order to incorporate your particular data source. And then I'll do a similar thing for the front end. And then hopefully, if there's time, there's one slide just to say where are we going to go next, integrating Zooniverse and other projects with the ESAP platform. Okay, so first of all, what is the Zooniverse? The Zooniverse is a citizen science platform which allows members of the public, so non-professionals in general, to access via the web and look at data that you provide, normally in the form of images or graphs or videos, and annotate them in a certain way. So those annotations can be in the form of answers to yes/no questions or two-dimensional clicks or things like that. So first of all, the website for Zooniverse is zooniverse.org, and if you go there, assuming you don't have account, you have the opportunity to register. So hopefully this will work, and hopefully you can still see, you can now see a different browser window. So if I go and sign in as me, like that, you can be able to go and have a look at my recent project. And I'm going to show you Galaxy Zoo. Actually, no, am I going to do that? Yes, I'm going to show you Galaxy Zoo Clump Scout because this is actually one of the projects that is funded by ESCAPE, which basically means that I work on it. So this is an example of one of the projects. We can actually do some classifications. So if I go and click on classify, the idea of this is that we're looking for clumps of star formation in images of galaxies. So this galaxy obviously has no clumps of star formation in it, but the first thing we need to do is draw a marker on the center of the galaxy. So we do that. It's a two-dimensional annotation. So we call that a classification. It's a form of data. And in principle, we would like to be able to process these data and infer some scientific results from them. We can go on to next. There are no clumps, so we're done with that one. Okay, so that's the end of them. Oh, this one did have clumps. How exciting. Right, so that's the end of the demonstration of that part, and that is what Zooniverse is all about, really. So the goal of what I've been trying to do is how we can get those classification data, in that case, two-dimensional coordinates, and consume them from the Zooniverse database where they're stored when I submit that classification into ESAP so that I can do what I like with them. I can submit them for batch processing, or I can analyze them using interactive data analysis. That was the oh, okay. So now I'm going to show you what's been done so far in terms of how that's integrated with ESAP. And so that's a quick demo, but really what I want to do is come to here and here. So hopefully you'll have had a look at the prototype ESAP data discovery interface. And when you first get there, you'll see something like this. You have a list of various archives that you can search. And one of those is the Zooniverse archive down here. And so what you can do is you can click to visit the Zooniverse archives, and you can see that there is a data set available here, which is a collection of one catalog in this case, and that is the Zooniverse Panoptes catalog. So a word to remember is Panoptes. That's just the name of the Zooniverse database. So if it pops up and it confuses you, hopefully now it won't. And we can now, by clicking on this button, jump into the browse catalog interface. And the first thing you'll hopefully notice is that the navigation has adapted in order to reflect the fact that we're now looking at the Zooniverse archives. So you now get a nice logo for Zooniverse, and the number of options has decreased. So there's a few things on this form that I wanted to highlight. The first is that it's actually a dynamic form. So at the moment, there are no catalogs selected. And in the current implementation, there are two catalogs available. One is the project catalog. So projects are things like Galaxy Zoo Clump Scout. And there is a workflows catalog. And a workflow is basically a set of tasks that can be defined within a project. And so one project can contain many workflows that operate on the same data or different data in different ways. Okay, so first of all, if I click on projects, you'll see that that populates a new field over here. And what that's done is that has gone, spoken to the back end very quickly. The back end has spoken with the Panoptes database. It has determined which fields are available in the project database, and then populated this list with them. So these fields are, in general, a little bit obscure, but for example, the number of classifiers on a particular project, some tags that are associated with it. And what you can see is I can select particular ones I'm interested in, whether the project is private, for example. Okay, the next thing is, I just wanna show, when you access the database, that database is huge. There are many, many projects. And so in principle, I could submit a general query and I would get a huge amount of data back. So one way to filter that is to supply my username. And at the moment also, if I want to see private projects that I can own, then I have to put in my own Panoptes password as well. But before I click, before I enter that password, I want to show you what happens if I submit without doing that. That's illustrating another feature of this, which is that it is going to validate the form before you submit it. So hopefully, if there's time, I will be able to show you how to implement all of these things in the back end. Okay, so I'm now going to enter my password. And the final thing that you'll notice is that this field behaves differently to all the others. This one is defined to be a password field, so you can't see what I typed, hopefully, which is good. Okay, so now I submit that. We go away, we're querying the results, and we get a list of projects. And the first thing that you'll see is it's paginated. So there are actually three pages of projects that I own or that I have access to. And you can also see that we're displaying a list of mandatory fields, which are these ones, plus the fields that I've selected from this list. So if I was to add another field in there, we would see, and then resubmit my query. Then we would see beta requested has appeared in the list of fields as well. Just test the pagination. It's dangerous. Is it going to break when we request a new page? That page isn't already on our browser. What actually happens is there's a query sent to the back end. The back end in this case actually issues another query to the Panoptes database, consumes those data, and then sends them back to the back end, to the front end, sorry. The only other thing that I want to do is show you, if I choose workflows, you can see it's actually updated the fields that are in here, because the same fields don't pertain to workflows as projects. And if I submit that query now, I'm not going to filter it. I'll just submit that query and we'll get a giant table. But what you can see, hopefully, when it comes back, is that because workflows are nested within projects, that query has rendered in a different way. So what we see now is we see, if I come down here, you can see here's Euclid Challenge the Machines, which is a project that has three workflows. So we've rendered that in a different way to the way that we rendered the request for project data. Okay, so that's the end of the demo. Let me jump, which way do I need to go? This way. Grant. So moving on now to a brief description of the data model and the very sort of 10,000 meter up view of the architecture of ESAP, the data discovery platform that is. So the data discovery model basically describes three entities, if you like, within its database. And those entities are as follows. They are archives, and archives basically describe instrument level data collections. So that's things like the archive for SK8, the archive for CTA. There are catalogs, which describe, if you like, specific tables of data or specific groups of images. And there are data sets, which are basically provide an abstract link between the two. Now, there's a lot of text on this page, so I think it's probably better just to show you it as a picture. So what you can see is you have an archive. An archive encapsulates several data sets, and data sets map from different catalogs into the results of a query. So what you can see is multiple data sets can consume from the same catalog, but perhaps they consume different columns or they apply different modifications to the data they consume. Or similarly, data set three is consuming from a completely different catalog. Okay. So I've given an example of what a data set might pertain to. So we've said that archives can be instruments. A data set might be, for example, the set of galaxies that have been imaged by an instrument, and that might consume from several catalogs. So say there have been several surveys for an instrument, they've all looked at galaxies. So if I want all the galaxies that have been seen by an instrument, I'll need to get several catalogs and query those. Looking at it from a more computational data flow point of view, it's important, I suppose, to bear in mind that there are several components to the way ESAP data discovery works. So there is a backend, and a backend is going to consume data from many remote data sources. Those data sources may be within the data lake, or they may be web resources, things like REST APIs. It draws its configuration from a configuration database, which I'll talk more about in a second. And it is in constant communication with the front end. So the front end is going to issue queries to the back end based on user interaction. And the back end is going to query its data sources, check any configuration data it needs from its own database, and then send those results back to the front end, which is then going to render them for the users and allow them to, for example, add those data to a shopping cart structure so that they can perform analysis on it later. Okay, so just moving on, I want to talk about the back end now. Very generically, well, first of all, most importantly, I suppose, if you want to look at the code for the back end, you can go to this GitLab repository. And as we go through the talk, I will be briefly jumping out and showing you bits of code that I think are important, so that you will be able to implement your own plugins, if you like, for the ESAP platform. So the backend is written in Python using a framework called Django, which if you've done web development, you're probably familiar with. The development implementation uses SQLite for its configuration database. Potentially when it goes to full deployment, SQLite will not be sufficient, so we'll move to something like Postgres or something like that. The good news, potentially for a lot of people, is that the backend as it is designed to basically implement connection with virtual observatory services as is, out of the box, as I've written. So if you have a data source that provides a virtual observatory type interface, then it's possible, I can't guarantee it, but it's possible you may not have to do any integration work at all. You might just have, well, you might have to update the database somewhere. However, in general, you're going to need to implement a couple of Python files at least and update one Python file as well as updating the database to integrate your data source. And so I'm now going to go through those stages. So the first thing is the backend database. I don't have time to go through how you would set up your local development instance of ESAP Gateway, but that is really well documented on the GitHub repo. Nico's done a great job with that. Even if you're having trouble, I'm not going to say pester him, but if he has time, he will help you as well. So that's really useful. So There's a list of things to do here, but again, I think it's probably easiest just to show you how you would do that. So this is once you navigate to this page, these two will depend on your own development environment. However, the stub of the URL is always the same. So you can see that's what's here. That's this stub here, and I'm on my own local host here. So let's jump to here, the query admin. And you can see that there are a list of different tables that we need to add items to. So there's the archives, there are the catalogs and the data sets that we've already spoken about. These two things I'm gonna say don't worry about for now because I haven't used them. So archives. If I click on archives, first of all, what you would normally do is add an archive, but just to show you what the different fields in an archive actually pertain to, I'm gonna show you the Zooniverse archive here. Okay, so the important thing to remember is actually the URI, and that's gonna be the case for the catalogs as well. Then you have the opportunity to define things that will affect how the GUI looks in the front end. So for example, the name of the archive, a description of it, and some longer descriptions and stuff like that. And perhaps you spotted as we were going through the demo, there were these tracts of text that were next to, for example, that big teal Zooniverse sigil. That's where these come from. So that's you fill in these and they get dynamically populated. Things like institute and the order in which they appear on the page can also be defined. This thumbnail is where that teal sigil came from. So that's how you define that thing. And there's also a little flag here so that if you're developing and you want to push to the deployment instance, if you like, you can set it to be invisible so that you're not going to annoy people by having some buggy implementation that's sitting there on the deployment instance and people won't be able to see what you're working on. Okay, let me jump back and look instead at catalogs. So I have two catalogs that are defined. There is the workflows catalog and the projects catalog. So let's just look at workflows for the sake of argument. Again, remember what this URI is. You will need it later. And the fields are very, very similar. What you can see is that when this database was first envisioned, they really had astronomy in mind. So Equinox originally was actually required. It's now an optional thing that you can set as not applicable. And also it was basically assumed that you would be querying some REST API. So you have a protocol which can be HTTP or ADQL and the URL that you're gonna send. Now, Zooniverse is not like that. So that's why perhaps it's interesting. I can show you how you can set this up to query an endpoint that isn't just a REST endpoint. And then finally, datasets. There are many datasets. The dataset name is Zooniverse Panoptes in this case. So I'm linking the Panoptes dataset the Panoptes catalogs with the Zooniverse API, although this name is freeform, you can call it whatever you want. Again, this thing you don't actually need to remember, but you probably should. The thing you need to remember from this page, if we come all the way down to the bottom, is this thing, the service connector. So the service connector is actually the name of a Python module. So the package in this case is, the module is Zooniverse and the Panoptes connector is the name of a class. So you do need to remember that because you're going to implement that class. And I think all of the other things here, oh yeah, and you can set the catalog and the data set archive as well. The archive and the catalog that are associated with this data set. So obviously I've just gone through and shown you these things pre-populated. You'll need to go through and populate them yourselves when you're adding your own data source. Okay, so I said make a note of the service connector and the URIs for the archives and the catalogs. That's quite important. So the next thing to do is look at the back end and how we specify the configuration of that GUI. How do we specify what fields are going to be in that GUI? How do we specify that some of those fields are going to be dynamically populated? How do we specify which ones are going to look like passwords and which ones are going to be required fields and things like that? So the generic answer to that is that we're going to use this thing called React JSON Schema Form, which is a package that's been defined to work with React, which is what the front end is built in, as we'll see later. You can go to that link and find out all about it. The file that we're going to in which we're going to define our schema using this particular format also defines the name for the GUI, which you also need to make a note of when you're working on the front end. It defines the appearance and the navigation options. So you remember when we went into the Zooniverse query form, the navigation bar changed its appearance. Okay, so you can define that here as well. And there are two data structures that specify the form structure. The first one is required, and that's called query schema. And that basically tells you things like the basic structure of the form, which form elements are required, and how they're populated. And then there is UI schema, and UI schema is basically there to define extra attributes on the individual field. So UI schema is where I'd say that the password field should behave like a password. And so I'm just going to show you the Zooniverse examples of those. It's probably easiest to do it this way. So this is the main file. So we just jump to here. And so these here are the elements which define what the navigation bar is going to look like. This is the element that defines what the logo is going to look like. So that's that Zooniverse word black that was up at the top of the query screen. And you need to define this navbar, and the navbar contains dicts in this case that look like this. Okay, so the most important thing is the query schema. This is the part of this file that's mandatory. And I don't have time to go through it in detail. You can go to the documentation to find out exactly how you should lay out this. The general form is in the form of a JSON dictionary, and that's because it's going to be serialized to JSON and then read in the front end by JavaScript as a JavaScript object. So dictionaries map to JavaScript objects quite nicely. How do I define that a field is required? I do that using this required key here. So I showed you explicitly that the password was required. However, it would have turned out that all of those fields were required. And then this is how I define dynamically populated fields. So there is a dependency, and dependency on catalog is, and once you've defined that, the dependency is on catalog. So when I select projects, for example, it will then populate that field with either this block, which is basically just another sub-schema, if you like, or this block, which is another sub-schema. And that's how that works. Now, what you'll notice is that when I'm putting in the values for these fields, this is actually a Python variable. And that's one of the nice things about this, is that I can put, rather than a static list of field names, which is perfectly fine if you expect that, because I want to be able to select specific fields to issue specific queries, I can compute the list of fields that are available on the fly and then send that to the front end. And so this P fields is actually computed in another file, which I'll show you in a second. Okay. Finally, UI schema. This is optional. It doesn't have to be in your file, but this is telling you that the Panoptes password field is a password. So basically it obscures the text that you enter like any normal password field. Okie doke. So I showed you briefly, or I teased the fact that there is another file for Zooniverse. You don't need to do this, but this is how Zooniverse implements dynamic discovery of what fields are available. So what it's doing here is it's using a client that was built by the Zooniverse project. I don't need to re-implement the wheel for this. So I can just use this Python client. And what I do is I issue a query using that Python client and say, what fields are available effectively in the projects database, and it will send me back a list of fields, and I format them appropriately and return them, and then I can use that to define my schema. Similarly for the workflow fields. Okay, so if you want to understand how I've done that dynamic field population, that's in this file. So you go to that one. All right. So the next thing that you need to implement once you've done the schema definition is something called a service connector. And you need to do one service connector for every data set. Okay, you implement that in a separate Python file. This is where you're going to need that service connector class that you remembered when you were defining your data set in the database. Each of those classes, and I'll show you an example in a second, is required to implement two methods. The first one is construct query, and construct query, the job is basically just to build a list of strings, and those strings, they are in a format, in this case, that you can choose as long as the other required method, which is run query, can understand what those strings mean, so pass them in some way, and then use them to construct a query or to issue a query to your data source and retrieve the data, and then format those data so that they can be sent back to the front end. Okay, so here's the example of that for Zooniverse. Well, I just skip down here. So this is construct query. Again, construct query, it's basically checks if we've got an instance of our Panoptes database connector. So there's a lot of efficiency code here, but basically what it's doing is it's connecting to the Panoptes database. It's saying, okay, yep, I've got that, I can proceed, and I've been able to establish a connection, and that means that I can proceed to construct a query. If I can't establish a connection, then the query is going to return false. So once it's done that, it then builds a query, and that query, as you can see, is basically here, it's key equals some parameter for the set of keys. And the only other thing to bear in mind is, because this is going to get sent as a URL, it's going to get sent as a URL parameter. You can't put an ampersand into your query, okay? So you have to define some sort of safe ampersand replacement. Otherwise, it will be interpreted somewhere along the line and passed out. And so in this case, my safe ampersand replacement is defined all the way up at the top. It's just a string safe, right? So it's something that's not going to occur naturally within the query string so that I can remove it later. Okay, so that generates my list of queries. Somewhere else in the code, things happen. You don't need to worry about that. All you need to worry about is that at some point, that list of queries is going to come back to you. And that's where your run query method needs to be able to process those queries. So here you can see it's re-tokenizing that query string, stripping out the ampersand replacement, and then it's forming an appropriate query that it wants to send to the Panoptes backend database. And it's sending that. Note here, and this will come up again, that it's actually doing some pagination. Okay, so the Panoptes backend supports its own built-in pagination. I'll talk more about that later, but just note that it's there. We connect, we issue the query, we get the results back, and then we format those results appropriately so that we can send them to the front end. The other thing to note is that we have our mandatory fields that come back, including pagination fields, so the requested page and pages. But then also, this is the dynamism coming in again. So this is where we're actually looking at all the fields that aren't mandatory fields that were in our query, and then adding those to our list of return values because we expect them to have come back as well. Okay, so it's complicated, but it doesn't need to be this complicated if you just have a static list of fields that you want to return, okay? Okay, and it does that. And the idea here is it's gonna return a list of results, and each result is a Python dict object. Okay, dynamically constructed again. And it returns that list, and that list gets serialized to JSON, and then sent to the front end, and then that gets consumed and rendered back out. Okay, so what you can see is that this first one, this was the results for projects. So it's fairly simple, it's just a list of dictionaries. This one is the result of workflows, and you can see that within the list of dictionaries, there is another nested list of workflows. Okay, so that's reflecting that structure that we saw in the front end. Okay, So that's that part of it. And there are some other things in here that I will come back to in just a second. So let's just jump over here and talk about the next thing. Let's have a look. There is one other thing that you need to do to make sure that your service connector is basically registered with the back end, so that when the back end is scouting around for things to connect to your service, it's going to find it. And that's that you need to modify, not implement, but modify a file. And that file is linked here. So if we just jump to that file, you can see that there is this list of recognized service connectors, and Zooniverse is in here. And what you can see is it takes the name of your service connector, splits it on the dot, and then takes the second part of it. So, okay, so this is Zooniverse in this case. All right, and that's all you need to do. So you would just put another elif here for your service, and away you go. You're all set to go. All right, so for some data sources, you might want to consider implementing customized pagination. And as you've already seen, I have done that for Zooniverse because it's going to be more efficient. Most will require you to specify, not default, should be custom serialization specifications. And for Zooniverse, we've done both, and that's required, as I've already said, because we have this dynamic specification of the fields that we want to retrieve. So serialization. The backend uses the Django REST framework serializers module, which you can go and read the documentation there. To support it, your service connector essentially must implement a nested create and run query serializer class, and the name of that class is fixed. Okay, so you must implement that class nested within your connector. If you have queries that are going to return a static set of fields, then that class is really easy to implement, because the names and types of the fields, they're just class attributes and they're static and you don't have to care. It takes 10 lines to write that class down. For the Zooniverse connector, because we want to dynamically define what fields are going to be available and returned depending on what our query is, we need to do something where when the serializer gets instantiated, we need to update the fields that are defined. So let me show you how I do that. We're back here again. So this is create and run query serializer. So the name is, as I've already said, the name is fixed and it has to be like that. So if this was just a normal one, what I would do is I would define a list of class attributes before outside any method, and they would be of the form of something like name equals and then one of these. So serializers float field or serializers integer field or something. I can't do that. So instead, in the initializer for my class, when it's instantiated, what I do is I look in my arguments, my keyword arguments for this keyword instance, and then I get from instance this example result. So that example result contains a list of keys and types. And so what I do is then go through those fields and pass them, and then use this other helper class here to define what type they should be based on the Python type. And then I use that to update the instance variable of fields for this. And then that allows this serializer, which inherits from serializer, to appropriately handle all of the results that I'm gonna throw at it when I get my queries back from the Zooniverse Panoptes database. Okay, so again, complicated version, the easy version is much easier. All right, and finally, pagination. Again, the backend has very sensibly used the built-in REST framework pagination module. Bear in mind though, that if you're using that default pagination scheme, what may well happen is if you issue a big query, the backend is going to issue that entire query to your remote data source, and that's gonna result in a deluge of data coming back, and then the backend is gonna paginate those data locally. Okay, so if your data source implements, as the Panoptes database does, its own built-in pagination, then it may be way more efficient to actually use that built-in pagination and just pass on a request for individual pages as they come in. You can disable the default pagination using either the connector class, which is the override, or you can use a query parameter from the front end. As I say, that will be overwritten if the connector class says, I'm disabling pagination. If you disable pagination, the query response that you return, and I showed you this when I was going through the code, it must include two keys, and those are requested page and pages, and they're both integers, and I think it's quite obvious what they mean. Okay, so if we very quickly jump back to this demo, what you can see is on the connector, so this is the connector initializer here, as distinguished from the serializer initializer, I've defined an attribute, which is pagination equals false, and that's going to disable default pagination. And then I've made sure, as I showed you before, that my result contains a field which has requested page and a field that is pages, and that will be used by the front end to manage its front end pagination. Okay, that was a ton of stuff. I've allocated space for questions on the back end. We're going to move on and talk about the front end next. So any questions so far?
Huge.
Yep.
In your case, you are when you are querying Zooniverse, you are querying directly the database, no? So in the construct query, you are through the database connector, you are querying directly the database. Am I right?
It's one step removed. So I'm not issuing, for example, I'm not issuing an SQL query. What I'm doing is I'm using a Python client that is handling all sorts of things like authentication and all of the stuff that you don't want to have to do by hand when you're dealing with an external data source. That's all handled by a Python client that is provided by the Zooniverse team. But beyond that, I'm not, for example, querying something that's been staged in the data lake, if that's your question.
Okay. No, well, I was interested in the case that when you are querying a REST service, if instead of querying directly the database behind the REST service, if you can send the argument of your query to the REST service. I'm not sure if I am explaining well.
No, you are, and you can do that. And there are other examples that implement the query that way. They're probably closer to how the VO implementation, so that the one that's built in, is implemented. I'm basically showing Zooniverse because it's as divorced as possible from what you might consider normal. And so I'm just showing how flexible the back end is. If I'm imagining someone's thinking, well, I could never possibly integrate my data source with this because it's hidden on some remote server or whatever. You can do it. If you can access it with Python, you can do it with the ESAP backend. That's what I'm trying to show.
Okay.
All right. Anyone else? Okay, well, I'm going to press on. So the front end. The front end is written in JavaScript using a framework called React that was originally developed by Facebook, but, you know, don't hate it because of that. The rendering and layout part of it uses something called React Bootstrap. Okay, so that's worth bearing in mind. We're not just rendering using raw HTML. We're using a JavaScript framework to do that as well. In general, you must implement, in fact, two JavaScript files. That's a typo. Two JavaScript files and update one within the front end in order to integrate your data source. And depending on how you want to render the results of your query, you may also wish to define some additional CSS styles if you know what you're doing, and you do that in the app.css. The GitHub repo for the front end is that link at the top. And if you want to be developing in React, you may want to go and look at, for example, the React.js docs or the React Bootstrap docs. So there's one thing I want to sort of get out of the way, and since this is a tech talk, I suppose a lot of people already know this, but just in case, back in the olden days when I first started working on web pages, there was this traditional model of how a web page would work, which was even a dynamic web page, which was where there would be a back-end server and it would be communicating with the database. And there would be a series of separate pages, maybe written in PHP or something like that. And each of those pages would have its own context and state that only really existed in the world of that page. You could pass things between using sessions and stuff like that. That's not how the ESAP front end works. So the ESAP front end is essentially, it's only one page, okay? And it's in constant communication with the back end. And what React does on that page is it continuously re-renders that page. It continuously re-shows different components on that page. Now, what effect does that have? I mean, who cares? The effect that that has is that it moves the contexts, so the sort of global data stores, if you like, from the component level. So the components are essentially the equivalent of pages, if you like, because they're going to show different things to the user. It moves that up to the page level so that all of the components have access to this global data store without having to pass stuff around in sessions and stuff like that. And then each of the components then maintains their own state. So you have this separation of state and global context. That is useful to keep in mind because when you're looking at the JavaScript code for the front end, it sometimes seems like variables and data just appear like magic from nowhere. And that's why, it's because you never actually left this one single page and that context is always still there. Okay, having got that out of the way, the first thing that you're going to need to do is implement a file to pass the query form. Okay, so when you click submit, some JavaScript kicks in and it will basically pass the results of your file onto another file, which is pass query form, which you should update. I'll show you in a second. And in updating it, what you're doing is you're then forwarding those data that have come from the query form through pass query form to your own custom file that is going to pass the data that you expect to get from that form, okay? Once it's passed those data, it's going to form them into something that looks like a query that can be sent up to the back end, okay? And it's that back end then that's going to react and call the create query and run query to send the query onwards to your data source, in my case, Panoptes. Okay, so let's just see how we would modify pass query form. That's the first thing. So this is pass query form. The first thing you need to do is add in an include for your custom file that you're about to define. And then all you do in this list of cases is just add Zooniverse and call your function. Now, this is where you need the name of the query schema that I said to remember that name. That's what this is. So GUI is the name that's taken from the query schema. I wonder if I've got it still somewhere. Let's just have a quick look. Yeah, ooh, not quite. No, I don't. That's unfortunate. Anyway, so that's where that comes from. And then once it's done that, it's going to forward your data onto this function, which we can now take a look at. And what this function does is, first of all, this is actually old code. This is where it used to be possible to make a query to all catalogs, which doesn't really make sense in the context of Zooniverse. So this path actually never gets taken down. You never go down this path in this file. In the other case, what it's going to do is it's going to look at the catalog. So, okay, that's where you need to remember the catalog URI. And it's going to say, okay, I'm going to pass that catalog then onto the, add it onto the query, along with the archive URI, which is Zooniverse, if you remember. And it's going to add that to the query and then add that to all of the other stuff that came from your queries. That's things like the password and the username. Add on the pagination results that have come. So then you're sending, I saying, I want from Zooniverse, I want the workflows, let's say, for Hugh Dickinson with Hugh Dickinson's secret password, and I want page 5 of that. And it's going to put all of that together, send it to the back end, and then wait for the back end to send the results back. So there are a few examples of this, actually. If I just jump to here, if you're having trouble, there are a few examples of different data sources that have implemented this form. So you can go and see how, which of those would be best for your particular data source. Which one do you want to emulate? Okay, so that's how you pass the query form. How do we render the results that we get back from the back end? Well, in this case, we have two files to update and one file to implement. So the first one to update is this file called query catalogs, and where we need again to remember the archive URI that we noted down. To that should be fairly obvious where we need to change it. So here we just add another case, set config name. Set config name is one of these magic functions. So set config name is actually modifying that global context. Okay. If you want to worry about it, by all means, go and read the React documentation, but really you could just copy and paste this as another block and replace with your archive URI in these two places. Okay. That's that bit. Then we need to update query results. Okay. And this is where you need the catalog URIs that you noted down. So we jump into how we're going to update that. And as you can see, we're going to issue a query for a catalog. We're going to render a different catalog. And remember, they render in different ways. So the projects render as a simple table, whereas the workflows render as a nested table. And that's why we have two different cases. So if the catalog URI is Zooniverse projects, we're going to render Zooniverse results using catalog, using a specific catalog. And in fact, you can see that they actually both do exactly the same thing. That's because I've updated it since doing this. So they just pass the catalog in, and then within this next file that we're going to look at, it's going to react to that catalog and do something specific. So what you're seeing is that it's still under development and I haven't quite got rid of all the inefficiencies in it yet. Okay, so this is the file that we actually need to implement, and this is the basically the one that does all of that rendering. Okay, so this is the guts of the front end for your data source. And that looks like this for Zooniverse. Okay, so don't panic, there's quite a lot of stuff here. I'm gonna go straight down to the bottom of this file. And this is Zooniverse results. So this is what we were calling from that previous file, and it receives catalog as its one argument. Then it's gonna do that thing where it's gonna access the global context. So this is that magic thing, like it's getting data from somewhere. It's gonna access that. It's going to check some stuff about the query. So has it actually received any data from the back end yet? That's all that's happening there. It's checking that. If it hasn't, it's going to issue an alert. It's going to say, well, you issued me with a query, but I couldn't get any results. Tough luck. And then it's going to check what the catalog is. So if the catalog is Zooniverse projects, it's going to call a different subfunction and render a different component. And if it's workflows, it calls this one. Okay. If it hasn't got any response yet back from the back end, it continues to show that loading spinner, which we saw when I did the demo. All right, so let's have a look. Let's go all the way up to the top now, because there are a few things to bear in mind up at the top. I have some helper functions that help me render particular data types in particular ways. So for example, you may or may not have noticed, let me see if I can quickly show you actually, it's probably the easiest way. Dates get rendered nicely. They're not stored like this in the Panoptes database. They're stored in some sort of standard format. They get rendered nicely. That doesn't happen for free. I've had to implement that. Okay, so that's what's happening here. I'm specifying some date options for how I want to render the date. Let me give you another example. Sometimes, let me see, you may find that there is, there's no great example, but you may find that your result contains an object nested within your JSON object, and you may want to continue to render that in a nested way. So that's what this is doing. It's going down into the sub objects and rendering those until it just gets down to basically plain old data types. That's doing this as well. This is rendering strings nicely instead of all being lowercase. Now, this is quite important. This is for the pagination, okay? So this is a callback that you're gonna pass to the pagination API. And in this case, it's actually really simple. All it's doing is checking what page has been clicked on and calling set page, yet another one of these magic functions. And all that's going to do is update that global context to say the page that's been requested is page X. Okay. And then when the page re-renders, that global context is persisted, and it's going to make sure that it issues the right query to the backend to get the right data to re-render them. Okay. The reason why this is a separate callback and we don't just call set page is because you may want to do other stuff here before calling set page. Okay. So that's why you do it as a callback. And I'll show you where that callback gets used in a second. Okay. Now we're down into those individual sub functions that are actually doing the rendering. Again, this is where we unpack that context. So we're pulling out data from the global context here. This is a function. This is the actual number of the page. And this is the query data. So this is the result of our data. I'm doing the date formatting that I showed you here with my date time options. That's fine. And then here what I'm doing is I am looking at the set of fields that I know are mandatory, filtering out those fields and then finding any extra fields. So this is the dynamic fields again, finding any extra fields that are there so that I know how many columns to plot in my table. Okay. Then we come down and once we've got all of that information, we actually plot the table. And the thing to bear in mind here is, remember I said we're using that React Bootstrap. So we're not using just a generic HTML table here. This capital T is supposed to let you know that actually this is a React class that we've got from React Bootstrap, and it's going to handle things like stretching, laying out, reacting to what device you're on, rotation, and all of that kind of stuff. So that has to be that kind of table. Once you've done that and you get down into these sub elements, these are also defined by React Bootstrap, but they look a lot more like just standard HTML. There is one thing, okay, CSS, if you're not familiar with React, CSS, rather than writing class for CSS, you have to write class name. And that's simply because this is actually all still in JavaScript and class is a reserved keyword in JavaScript, okay? So if I want to specify a CSS class, then I have to use class name like this. So that's what's going on there. And so I render the table header. And then I come down and for this simple table, I'm just taking the query results, mapping over them in JavaScript. And for every result I come to, I'm returning a new table row with lots of table cells. So this is cell, cell, cell. These are the mandatory fields. You can see they go up like that. And then the remaining cells I've computed up here. So these are the ones that are left over. And again, this is me implementing that dynamic query field. Okay, this is the pagination bit. You saw there was a pagination up at the top, and there's also a pagination down at the bottom. This is going to go away and call something that, again, you don't really have to worry about. It has some bells and whistles that you can tweak. So the first one is the callback that's going to get called when you click to get a new page. And remember, I already showed you that. So we use our new page callback. And then we're passing into that the set page, and that's the set page that we got from that magical global context up at the beginning of this function. So I can show you that. Where does that come from? That comes from there. Okay. So we're making sure we've got the right set page, passing it to our function to make sure that we're setting the right context. And that's how pagination works. The number of adjacent pages is basically saying, a maximum of 3 to the left or 3 to the right, depending on where I am in the stream of pages. So I could, that's basically the at most 7 cells ever displayed in that case. And then this is the total number of pages that are available. And if you remember, that's one of the things that you must send back if you override the pagination for your class. So that was the project results. And for the workflow results, it's very, very similar. It's just that slightly more complicated because remember we have that nested structure. Okay. So again, here we have a workflow and we're just having that nested structure within. So there's another table within the main table. And so I don't really have time to go through and explain that, but the extra complexity is because we're displaying that nested table here. Okay, let's jump back. We're nearly at the end, so can we read the side? I've just done that walkthrough of Zooniverse results. I talked about all of that stuff, so that's great. So, last slide, what's coming soon? So the next thing that I want to do is implement a way to add the classification data that you've discovered. So let's say I find a really interesting workflow and I need that classification data because I want to work on it. How do I add that to my shopping cart? Something that's being worked on now. How do we then propagate those data in my shopping cart, those resources to, for example, Jupyter Notebook running somewhere to do interactive data analysis? So that's going in one direction, that's going from Zooniverse into ESAP and into the ESAP analysis pipeline. The other thing I'm quite excited about is, can we go in the opposite direction? Can we generate new projects on Zooniverse using data, let's say from the data lake, let's say from one of the escape S3s? Can we generate a new project just from within the ESAP interface? And so the way that I'm thinking of doing that now is being able to define this global escape user, and you would be able to then grant that escape user access to a project that you've developed on Zooniverse. And by doing that, it will allow the escape user to basically put new subjects onto the project, to add new pedagogical material to the project and do all kinds of things like that. So how do you do that? Well, obviously you log into the front end with your escape user credentials through, let's say, the escape AMI or something like that. And then there is this one single set of credentials for the escape Zooniverse user that the backend can consume. So they're held by the backend somewhere. And then the backend is going to use those to communicate with Zooniverse. So there's implications for this, which is that implicitly everyone within escape trusts everyone else within escape to be able to access their private projects. If that's not true, then we have to think of a different way of doing this. Okay, so any questions now? And that's the end, by the way.
Thanks, Hugh. It's really impressive how you did the presentation. I think you really explained very well how this is done and how you can add a new project in terms of what you need to implement. And I think this set of slides is really a great set of documentation also for our focus months, so that we can use this as let's say a kind of tutorial for a new projects to implement their stuff. And yeah, really great. Thank you. So are there questions to you? No? Okay. I also don't have questions because I actually myself used to look through the Zooniverse implementation and doing it with the Loafer implementation. So I would say it just like Hugh explained, it's really easy to do, and most of the time you basically just copy paste things that's already there that you need to update, and the only thing you need to implement is so the really your project specific files. It's really great, and thank you all for coming. If you have any questions regarding this, you can of course always contact Hugh or Nico or me, so I will be able to bring you to contact with to the right person to answer the questions. Yeah. Thank you.